Camelback Master Reel 2.
I said to him, "You are there, you stay there," in French, of course. And the girl got this message from George, slapped him on the back and gave him a Legion of Honour. He's that sort of unpredictable person that you can't really, you could never tell in advance what he was going to do.
When, under what circumstances did you actually meet him personally?
Well, he came to Baker Street to find out about various operations that were then in progress. I mean, not only with regard to my particular lot of people, but to others working the escape routes and those sort of people. I mean, I met him in front of the war map, in fact, in the operations room. It was not a very formal meeting. It was just he shook hands and said, I know what you're doing. You can remain in touch with Passy. And so I was fine. That suited me. That's what I had to do anyway. That was his number two, his man of the Office of the Information and Action.
Was he a remote man, as some people have described him?
Yes. Yes, very. He was concerned only with the fair name of France. He resented anything which on which he had to rely on other countries, or particularly Britain, to enable him to do what he had to do. And he was very ungracious about the way in which he accepted that help. But, I mean, he was a patriot above all, and I admired him greatly because he was a very honest and very determined and very patriotic man.
Did you like him or dislike him, or was it, did you not have sufficient contact with him to be able to say?
Well, I can't say that I liked him because he was a very unlikable kind of person, but I admired him.
I think you said that in your books that as far as the recruitment of people was concerned, that you liaised with Scotland Yard. Recruitment of agents?
Well, with MI5, to a certain degree. But, I mean, we would check up and see that there was no record about them, yes. But not more than that, no.
So how did it work? You would just ring them
well,
up, would you?
Well, we would be put in touch with someone, possibly through a relation or a close friend. I mean, for instance, the typical case was one like that of Jacqueline Nairn, who was the daughter of the British consul in Boulogne, and she had been friends, had made acquaintance with one of our other existing officers who had already been chosen, and he learned that she was coming over to this country and advised me to get in touch with her, and indeed she proved to be the most outstanding success, wonderful girl. Maurice Southgate was her friend, and he worked for us right away almost from the start. Well, people were put in touch with us. The main requirement was absolutely perfect French. I mean, the French of a Frenchman and not that of someone who has learned French. The natural Frenchman. We didn't have all that much trouble in finding all the people that we wanted. I had one occasion, which I think is quite amusing, where I was told that a young man called Monsieur Larsonnier was a recruit, and I thought to myself, I bet this is the son of Robert Larsonnier, who I mentioned before was my tutor, French tutor at Eton. So I duly went to see him, and he's an awfully nice boy, but he had a British accent, so I had to write to his father and say, you managed to teach me to speak French without an accent, but you haven't succeeded with your own son. A few laughs about that. But by and large, once we had covered the language problem, the next thing was to find out much more about the motivation, whether they were prepared to take this job as being a very serious and very real activity, or whether it was rather to show off and brandish a lot of arms about. If they were no use to us. They had to be people who were prepared to undertake the task of recruiting in France, recruiting and training and seeing through and helping, guiding French patriots to do the job, but not to go off half-cock and not to do it until they were ordered to do whatever it was. And in the meantime, to find sabotage work which could be done without involving them in the more important tasks for which they were being trained.
You described in one of your books a particular chap called Nigel Lowe, who was described as some kind of confidence man. Did you ever hear of him again?
No, not really, no. No, he dropped out of my knowledge, really.
You, again, in your books, you talked about the faked Gestapo interrogations which were conducted.
Yes.
Did you set those up yourself?
Well, with help. I mean, I wasn't able to do it on my own, but we had... Well, now, Vera Atkins would be very useful in that. She would be the sort of person that would know how that would be carried on.
Did you attend them yourself?
Not always. Sometimes. It depended. It depended on how much was happening. And I couldn't guarantee to be at everything, because with 480 people, not altogether true, but, I mean, over the years, it wasn't very easy to devote a lot of time to the training of any particular person. When they were trained, there were people who had been engaged to do the training and who were best left to do it themselves. I used to see them all before they went into the field, of course, and I got to know them well, and we became friends, and I used to give them a present or something or other. But it established a basis of what you might call family friendship, not I didn't interfere in the elementary business of training, or the further bits of training. If I was told that they had been properly trained, I accepted that.
I think at one stage you were transferred to work on Belgium.
Yes, that's true. That was only for a brief period in July 41, where something went wrong. The head of the Belgian section disappeared, he was ill or something, and I was put in by Charles Hambro to take charge of the Belgian section. Well, I didn't really, I don't know Belgium anything like as well as I know France, and I didn't really get involved in that. I'd already got very much involved in the French section, and so I was delighted when Charles Hambro switched me back again into the French section to take charge of it in September.
So the Belgian section was just concerned with the Walloons, was it? Or the
well, no, well, Belgium as a whole, both Flamands and Walloons. But it was run by Claude Knight, who is still alive and was living just down this next village. And Hardy Amis was with him.
Was the Belgian section divided into a Walloon and a Flamand section?
No, it was all one.
We were talking about earlier on about agents who were turned. Could you tell me something about that? Or people who worked as double agents?
Well, yes, it's not easy just to sort of... The whole thing is a very long, drawn-out and very complicated affair. And you're no doubt referring to a man called Delicourt. Well, Delicourt was a very good airman, and his advice and help about finding suitable lands, suitable ground for Lysanders to land on was invaluable. In fact, there was no one else in France who had anything like his knowledge of what was needed in respect of landing grounds. We used him for that purpose, and a lot of great number of operations were carried out with great success on his help. What happened was that he was then approached, I think, and I don't know this, I can't prove it, and nobody will ever prove it, because Delicourt's dead. He must have been approached by a German with whom he had worked before in some other life that he had before the war, who persuaded him to work also for the Germans. And he tried to work for both sides. And, I mean, his main object was to get more money. He was badly keen on money, and he tried to sell, to obtain money for everything that he did. which is not a very desirable trait, but nonetheless, if he could produce results which were of that value, it was worthwhile considering him. We were well aware of his possible weaknesses in being cajoled by the Germans to do this or that, but we thought that, on the whole, he did very much more good for us than he did for the Germans.
Was there, if you suspected someone of working for the Germans, or you felt that you'd established it, was it just a question of cutting contact with them, or could they be silenced in any way?
Well, you could cut. The obvious thing to do was to cut contact entirely. I mean, we weren't in the business to go and shoot people up.
Were there any other individuals apart from Derrico?
Not that we realized at the time. I mean, some people had been turned, and we were still in touch with them. Pierre Cuglioli, for instance. But he, in a sense, he rendered us great services before he was switched. We lost, unfortunately, we lost good men and good women through treacherous double agents. It happened particularly in the Paris area. But that represented, in fact, only a very small proportion of the area of France in which we were operating at that time. I mean, when the BBC, for instance, if I may refer to this...
Yes.
No, the business of double agents, it was a tragic thing that we lost, for instance, Francis Suttill, which was largely due to the particular orders which he'd received from Churchill. And that involved the loss of other people too, people like McAllister and Pickersgill, who were lost to the enemy through a slip which should not have occurred, but which inevitably one can't foresee everything when you're working in those conditions. The idea that it was a total catastrophe is very misleading, because in point of fact it was only a relatively small part of a total operation which throughout the whole of France involved 480 people.
Yes, I think you were saying that various broadcasters recently have tried to exaggerate the importance.
Yes, well, that's what brought it to my mind, was the broadcast not so very long ago on Time Watch, that it was the biggest catastrophe of the war for SOE. Well, and it also, they tried to line it up with a whole lot of innuendos about dirty deeds between MI6 and SOE, about which I am totally ignorant. I don't believe them happened at all.
Another thing you mention in one of your books was about the postbox system from Paris to Spain. Can you tell me how exactly that worked?
Well, yes, up to a point. It was largely concerned with the escape route work, but if we had to use the line for one of our agents who was in difficulties or was likely to be in difficulties and wanted to bring him out for further briefing and send him back again, we used to work on the business of the patrulleries, escape routes, which used post boxes and which had a group of passeurs, of people who took people across the Pyrenees into Spain. It's not a very elaborate organization. There was nothing very special about that.
As far as the personal work that you were doing in London was concerned, how much strain did you operate under?
Oh, very considerable strain. Because when a message came in from the decoding operation, very often an answer was required very rapidly. Which had to be set out for coding again. And we had to do it at whatever time of day or night it arose. And so very often, it was more often in the middle of the night than any other time. And one was perpetually concerned to get all the relevant facts ready so that the answer could be set out with absolute conviction and full knowledge. You see what I mean? One couldn't just wait until something happened and then deal with it. One had to prepare in advance for when we get the answer back from so-and-so, we'll have to decide immediately whether this or that or the other operation is likely to take place, and then let them know. And we've got to do that in the space of about 10 minutes. So it's a strain at that point, yes.
I think you talk in your books at one stage about working 18 hours a day.
Yes, that's right.
How many days a week would that be?
Well, it depends very much. I mean, you might get one day, one night off for a sleep, but by and large, you were on duty 24 hours a day. And I slept in the office most, if I slept at all. And I mean, I used to couch down. I'm very lucky in the sense that I can get to sleep very quickly, and I just lie down and I go to sleep. But I did need more sleep than I was able to get in those days, and it was a very great strain for a long time. It was much more so, of course, in the 1943-1944 period, and particularly, of course, around the D-Day period. That was a greater strain than any other time. And in the early days, you generally had reasonable enough amount of time to prepare yourself and get things ready so that you didn't have to work under pressure right around the clock.
Was there ever such a thing as holidays for you?
No, there weren't any holidays. I had 287 days leave due to me, I think it was, at the end of the time. I mean, I don't say that I didn't have a day off in the sense of I went to see my wife perhaps 2 days in the week for 3 or 4 hours, whether it be at night or on the morning or any time. But if I could do that, I would naturally take the opportunity of doing so. I used to have a bicycle down from Baker Street to where we were living in a flat, and then bicycle back again. Particularly at the time of the V1s and things, I used to have the bicycle, the V1s circling overhead. It wasn't funny.
So by the time that you resigned from SOE, you must have been glad it was all over.
Well, I was relieved that it was all over, yes. I mean, I took a great deal of pride in the work that I was trying to do, and I was very anxious that it should be regarded as being a satisfactory job. Of course, I was relieved when the necessity arose, and so delighted to begin to meet again the people that we'd sent out, because there was tremendous, as I say, there was a tremendous family affection between us all. But I don't say that I was only thankful it was all over. No, I think that'd be untrue to say that. I was relieved that it had gone off as reasonably well as it had done. I was, of course, concerned that some things had gone wrong. I was equally pleased that other things which I had been very doubtful about perhaps turned out rather better than I expected. But it was a question of ups and downs, you see what I mean.
I think that, again, in one of your books, you talk about Sir Samuel Hawes' comment to Dennis Rake about, I sometimes think that some of you people are more trouble than you're worth. Did that type of comment make you angry?
No, not really. I mean, I dismissed it in scorn because he obviously didn't know what the hell he was talking about.
But would that type of comments often be made, or was it very unusual?
No, very rare. Very rare.
Can you talk about the achievements of SOE?
French section.
Of the French section?
Yes, I mean, I think the main achievement was the hindrance caused to the German Panzer divisions, particularly the Hermann Göring division from Andai in Spain, in the Spanish border, getting into the battlefront in Normandy, and the same thing in the Das Reich division in the southeast, where in each case the resistance put up such an amount of ambush and barricades and stoppages on the route that they that the total strength of the panzer divisions crossing the Loire was minimal. It had no effect on the fighting at all, and that was considered to be a very important event. And indeed, I quite understand it, because they had, if those panzer divisions with all their armored tanks and everything else had been able to attack the British troops, the British and American troops, as they landed, or shortly after they landed, God knows what would have happened. They might well have been swept back into the sea. But as those two panzer divisions were prevented by the Maquis and the ambushes from getting into the battlefront, it gave room and gave time for the consolidation of the front on the Normandy foothills. And that, I think, was the most important and meaningful operation. The SOE did an important job, too, in France, in sabotaging such people as the aircraft factories and the battery factories and the ball-bearing factories all over the place. The railways, I mean, the amount of damage to rolling stock which was used for transporting Germans was tremendous. Lille, Fives Lille, Troyes, where the railway terminus, or the railway depot, was completely knocked out by Ben Cowban and his people. I mean, those sort of operations, I mean, I can't begin to give you a list of them, because there is, in fact, a very good list in Foote's book. The operation in the summary, that is quite well done. The amount of equipment shipped in and the amount of operations undertaken, that is quite well done in the appendix to Foote's
SOE
in France.
We mentioned one or two individuals who you said were in ignorance of what you were doing, some VIPs, but were there individuals whom you would like to mention who showed a real appreciation for what you'd done in the French section? Outsiders?
Well, that's a very difficult one. I think the answer is probably that Eisenhower's comment that the action of resistance in France probably shortened the war by up to 6 months. That is the highest tribute that one can hope for, and one which I regard with the greatest pride and indeed gratitude. There were others, of course. I mean, I think that even from Monty we had a word of goodwill. But by and large, there wasn't enough known about it for other people to make any comments.
You've already said something about recent broadcasts
yes,
in connection with SOE French section, but are there any other comments you'd like to make about what has been broadcast and written over the years about SOE and about the accuracy of it?
Well, so often these books are written by people that weren't even born in the time, and they don't realize that one author of a book suggested it would have been very much better if we'd sent heavy armor over to the French to enable them to resist. Well, if you could produce an airplane that could carry anything bigger than a Sten gun and a Bren, I would have gladly done so. But they weren't there. It wasn't in existence. They simply do not understand the shortcomings of the radio operation which we could undertake. They judge with hindsight without realizing the difficulties which were facing us. I mean, those people, their views are pretty valueless because they're totally transformed by that. I think that there are a number of there have been some things on BBC a long time ago, Moonlight something or other, I think it was called, which was quite good. Idea. But by and large, the media don't seem to have penetrated the fact that the task of SOE was to train and recruit people to take active work. They cannot differentiate that from espionage, which is a totally different operation. And I think that's where the broadcasting, in many cases, has gone wrong.